Welcome to the November podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pincham. The November issue is on the topic of neuroimaging of degenerative and traumatic encephalopathies. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Meng Law of the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, California, speaks with Dr. Michael Zehner of Stanford University, Stanford, California. They discuss Dr. Zehner and colleagues' article, 7 Tesla MRI and Neuroimaging Biomarkers for Alzheimer's Disease.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Meng Law. I'm the Director of Neuroradiology at USC Keck Medical School. And I'm here this morning with Dr. Michael Zehner, MD, PhD, who's the Assistant Professor of Radiology at Stanford University Medical Center. Mike received his Bachelor of Science at Caltech in 1995, obtained his MD, PhD from UCLA, and subsequently completed his radiology residency and neuroradiology fellowship at Stanford. He's been assistant professor of radiology since 2010. He's done some remarkable work on imaging in traumatic brain injury and other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease. This morning, we'll be talking to Mike about his paper, 7 Tesla MRI and Neuroimaging Biomarkers of Alzheimer's Disease. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Meng. Thank you so much for having me on your kind introduction.
Sure. So this is a very important topic for all of us, as probably 30-40% of us will end up with dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And so the imaging and finding biomarkers are going to be very critical. What are your thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree more. It's just every other aspect of medicine is making people healthy enough that they live longer, and then all of us are going to end up in our 80s, and half of us will have dementia. And it's important from several fronts. First, we still don't really understand the details of how Alzheimer's works, how amyloid pathology results in neurodegeneration, how that results in tau accumulation. And the basic science is still not there in terms of understanding what's going on. And that makes the challenges from developing a biomarker and intervening, especially when the current running hypothesis is that damage starts happening 20 years before dementia's onset. It's a really critical problem for society to invest in these kinds of research and technology and resources to understand this problem.
Sure. Yeah, the crux of your review and your paper studies, three primary neuroimaging biomarkers, and that's atrophy, secondly, a molecular characterization of things like amyloid and tangles and microglia, and then lastly, microinfarcts. And, you know, for me in particular, as director of the neuroimaging core for the ADRC here at USC, we have a tremendous interest in the vascular contributions to Alzheimer's dementia, and you very nicely described some overlap between vascular disease and microinfarcts and vascular dementia versus true Alzheimer's dementia. And so a lot of patients, in fact, have both. Would you like to comment about that?
It's interesting both scientifically and conceptually. So 7T MRIs, particularly with the real high resolution, we can see more subtle pathology than that can be seen at other field strengths. There's two components, there's essentially several components of how this is related to AD in particular. One is the two-hit hypothesis of AD, meaning on the one hand that there's amyloid and tau pathology and perhaps microglia and that resulting in neurofibrillary tangles and neurodegeneration and synaptic dysfunction and the cognitive and mnemonic decline that occurs in Alzheimer's disease. The other half of it is this kind of concept of cognitive reserve. Like, well, what is the starting substrate for the brain to work with? We know things like traumatic brain injury increases your risk of AD. We don't know why exactly, but it might be that there's just less overall substrate to degenerate, and then your threshold where you start having cognitive symptoms is more easily reached. The other side of it is we don't know, about, for example, there's a crossover between amyloid angiopathy and the amyloid and Alzheimer's disease, and is there some problem that's primary to the vasculature behind Alzheimer's? That's an unknown, but it is certainly an interesting and different way to look at the pathology of Alzheimer's disease. And as quantitative techniques are getting better and better, you know, in the future we could more realistically quantify how many little microinfarcts are there, how that correlates with overall atrophy and contributes in a separate manner. So that certainly is an interesting aspect of evaluation of Alzheimer's pathology.
Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about directly imaging amyloid plaques and ion and so on at 7 Tesla, which you described in your paper. As a follow-up to that last question, you didn't also mention that there are a number of patients that do have Alzheimer's that, in fact, don't have amyloid in the brain. So how do you reconcile that then with patients that do have amyloid and that have Alzheimer's versus patients that phenotypically have Alzheimer's but don't have any amyloid in the brain?
My understanding of that literature is it's pretty rare to have Alzheimer's type pathology without Alzheimer's disease. Are you talking about PART? Are you talking about primary age-related tauopathy of the hippocampus?
You mentioned in your paper that phenotypically true Alzheimer's patients that have dementia, some of them at postmortem, actually we don't find any amyloid in it. And so the reason why I'm asking is because in your description of these biomarkers, you talk about microinfarction and the vascular component of it. And our two-hit hypothesis here at USC is that, yes, amyloid and tangles and tau probably contribute to the neuronal loss and eventual memory loss. But what actually precedes that is actually a vascular component. And the vascular component involves, again, two hits. One involves decrease in brain blood flow and perfusion, and the second is an increase in blood-brain barrier permeability, which allows the amyloid and the tau to deposit in the brain. So these two hits, whether you're predisposed with APOE4 or whether you have traumatic brain injury, allows the amyloid to get into the brain. And then the decrease in perfusion decreases the clearance of amyloid and tau from the brain, then thereby allowing it to deposit and cause the memory loss. So in effect, there's a very close relationship between vascular disease and the vascular contributions to amyloid deposition and then eventually Alzheimer's disease.
Well, I think that's an interesting theory and hypothesis. I do think it's a challenge to prove that's the pathogenesis, that some other insult comes first and then the amyloid stuff after. The other thing is, like, in Down syndrome, they have an extra copy of the amyloid precursor protein gene. So, they get Alzheimer's early. That's a primary risk factor in and of itself, and there's not inherently any injury associated with that. I think it's an interesting theory. I think it'll be challenged to prove that, but I do think it's an interesting theory.
Yeah, in one of your figures, I guess, you have these graphs of imaging biomarkers and stages finding abnormal clinical function and memory loss, and then obviously preceding that there are changes in brain structure and atrophy, and then prior to that, amyloid and tau. So I guess our theory is that even preceding the tau and amyloid getting to the brain, there are some neurovascular changes that that occur probably fairly early on in the brain.
It's certainly possible. I don't think we got too into that in this paper.
Yeah.
What are the things that start this cascade? I don't know the answer. Well, I mean, you would predict then, based on that, people with hypertension and diabetes would have, like, greatly increased risk of AD. And I actually don't know how greatly increased the risk is of AD in that population off the top of my head. But
yeah, it actually is significantly increased if you have vascular risk factors like hypertension, diabetes, and smoker, and so on. So, but let's talk a little bit about imaging at 7 Tesla, because obviously Stanford, there is a 7T. Have you had much involvement with the 7T scanner at Stanford?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a part of most of those Kirchner studies that were cited in the first part of the paper.
Can you describe the coil and how long has the scanner been installed at Stanford?
Been here since, I think, 06 or 07, but then in around 09, it got an upgrade in terms of both the hardware and the receive coil in particular got much better. And then there was another upgrade in terms of the gradient hardware and the coil around 2012, 2013. So it has high performance gradients on it, which is good for really high resolution imaging. It has a high quality 32 channel Nova head coil on it. It is a long bore magnet, so it's when subjects go in, they go all the way in until their feet are in. Now that's somewhat like the way 3T magnets were 15 years ago. So we've had the magnet for a while. The hardware it's a GE magnet. The hardware has improved, both the gradient hardware and the coils have improved, and our software capabilities have improved with more different options of parallel imaging and more sequence options.
Sure. So do you think that, currently 7 Tesla scanners are investigational only, do you think the 7T will ever be FDA approved for clinical use?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's three manufacturers, the two main ones are Siemens and GE, and Siemens, they're in the application process for FDA approval. I believe GE is heading in that direction. I'm not sure what their stage is, but yeah, no, I mean, it's something that's coming up.
And you talk in your paper about using 7 Tesla with gradient echo imaging and QSM and SWAN and so on, and almost directly imaging amyloid plaques in sunny ion. Do you think that might be a possibility for us to actually directly image tau or amyloid or some of these proteins in the brain?
Yeah, that's a great and interesting question. This feeds into some of the other research I do here. So the big question is, we want to image the inherent pathology, which we're still trying to understand. And with 7T, we can get from macroscopic down to microscopic. And the question is, well, if we see something, what is it? So in this review paper, I cite a neurobiology of aging paper where we took some Alzheimer's brain specimens and we imaged them ex vivo. That is, we took the specimens themselves and imaged them on an ex vivo 7T magnet. And we found an interesting finding of hypointensities, or just little dark spots, in the hippocampus. And they were particularly concentrated in a part of the hippocampus called the subiculum. And we're all, well, okay, that's pretty cool. That's neat. Next question is, what is it? Is it amyloid? Is it? So, you know, I don't think MR ever really has a chance of directly visualizing because it's intracellular inclusion things. It's just too small. Amyloid plaques can be anywhere from 25 to 50 to 150 microns in size. So it's within the realm of possibility. One can get images that are 100 micron in plane. They're thick, but you can get images that are 100 micron in plane. And then there's, you know, other reasons for iron deposits. So part of my goal and philosophy in terms of using 7T is to translate pathology findings and in vivo findings. So we took these specimens, we did histology on them, we co-registered it together, and we did find that it was iron that we were seeing. It wasn't amyloid directly. And most of the iron was in microglia. And traditionally, Alzheimer's has been thought of as there's two pillars of Alzheimer's pathology, and you can almost hear this quote in like so many papers been written. The pathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease are amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles. A lot of people are interested in the inflammatory side of Alzheimer's disease, and it's something we're very interested in here at Stanford because potentially a different component of Alzheimer's disease that has not been well enough explored. Genome-wide association studies have found numerous immune genes associated with Alzheimer's disease. So these are, you know, pretty unbiased studies. They're just looking at everything, and the genes that they find happen to be the ones that are immune-associated. But the pathways whereby iron and microglia are involved in Alzheimer's pathology, it's really not well-established. And microglia in particular are very difficult to study. So it's interesting and uniquely compelling if 7T can get a window to Alzheimer's pathology that nothing else can see right now. You know, there's no clinical scan you can get right now to look at microglia. People are working on this PET tracer-wise, but I don't know which is going to work better.
Do you think there's an opportunity here to image inflammation at 7 Tesla with AD and other? How would we go about doing that?
So we kind of did the first step in terms of looking at the pathology, ex vivo and in vivo. That was a really exciting study. It was technically very difficult to do, and it was a small sample size. So we're working on doing that with more AD samples and more stages of AD to characterize it in further detail. And the second thing is to really push on the technical development side to really see how high resolution we can get with 7T MRI, and deal with things that we talk about some in the paper about the challenges of 7T in terms of P1 inhomogeneity and motion artifacts, among other challenges of doing these studies at 7T. So I think it's two front. One is continuing to look at this pipeline of characterizing ex vivo micropathology, translating that to ex vivo MR findings, and trying to translate that to in vivo MR by really pushing the technology.
Yeah, no, I strongly believe that the precursor or the very early marker in Alzheimer's, and most of these neurodegenerative diseases, is inflammation. So whether inflammation is related to genetic abnormalities or traumatic brain injury or even environmental factors. We actually had a paper recently this year in Neuron that showed that the blood-brain barrier is in fact leaky in aging and in patients with mild cognitive impairment. So that likely occurs prior to the amyloid getting into the brain. So the advantage with obviously using MRO or something like PET for imaging amyloid and tau is that we can, you know, use it very early on. And my feeling is that the amyloid gets into the brain probably very early in our lives, whether you have a predisposition or not. So scanning even subjects in their teens, I think in some subjects we'll probably start finding amyloid. So to be able to find a way to do it with MR, I think would be very useful.
At the same time, I think PET has proven pretty well it can see the amyloid plaques. I don't think MR is going to win on the amyloid front. I think MR could win on the iron and microglia and neuroinflammation front, not directly on the amyloid front. The challenge with amyloid and PET is that we're seeing the plaques, and we know the plaques aren't the things that are causing the problems. It's a soluble amyloid, but nobody knows how to visualize that. So,
has anyone at Stanford looked at iron oxide particles and paratoxamol in terms of looking at iron and inflammation in the brain in AD and other neurodegenerative diseases?
People have been interested in a couple diseases, or people interested in brain tumors. I think it's very interesting, but the black box warning issued by the FDA on Ferraheme, I don't know. I think that's a pretty strong warning that was issued, and it makes doing these kind of studies much more difficult. I think there is a potential future in that. I don't know if it's going to be in Ferraheme. It might need to be a newer agent that has a lower toxicity profile, a lower, you know, risk of anaphylaxis.
Thanks, but I don't know if you have any final comments or thoughts you want to share with us, but the paper certainly is a very nice summary and review of imaging at 7 Tesla with some very exquisite images of the hippocampus and also microinfarcts that we can see both in the white matter and also in the subcortical and cortical areas. I think that's something that's very exciting for us.
The only final comment to make is one of the other mysteries of Alzheimer's is we don't understand is why is the medial temporal lobe involved first? Such a simple question.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody has figured out.
Well, you mentioned in your paper that, in fact, this is not necessarily specific. We see in epilepsy, we see some volume loss in traumatic brain injury, we also see it in schizophrenia. So certainly it's an interesting part of the brain that is affected by many diseases, and why is it?
Absolutely. Why does this tau start in the interneural cortex? Why there?
Yeah, we don't know. I mean, I'll send you the paper in a minute, but our neuron paper actually shows that the blood-brain barrier is leakiest in the hippocampus compared with other parts of the white matter and gray matter. So whether that has something to do with it, I'm not sure. But it's.
I'd be very happy to read your paper. Thank you for sharing that.
Cool. For readers who are interested, the paper that we mentioned is published in Neuro in 2015. First author is Axel Montagne, Montagne, and the title of the paper is A Blood-Brain Barrier Breakdown in the Hippocampus in the Living Human Brain During Normal Aging. I believe it was in the January edition of Neuro in 2015. All right, well, thank you, Mike. Thanks for the
excellent
paper, and thanks for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the November issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the December issue, when the topic will be Defining, Measuring, and Predicting Quality in Neurosurgery. Follow the JNS on Twitter at #TheJNS, and please like us on Facebook at Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org. Thank you for listening.